Hello, this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. I'm Jamie Rosales, health advocate and executive director. I'm joined today by our producer here at the Fight Back podcast, Robert Molnar. Our nonprofit's mission is to help you navigate the complex healthcare system and understand your legal rights, options, and opportunities when you encounter problems and obstacles. We want to empower you with the information you need to fight back and get the best possible care. Today on the Fight Back podcast, we discuss the latest information about the COVID-19 pandemic progressing into an endemic and the new medical diagnosis of long COVID. What does this mean for our healthcare process and access to services? Does anything change? And while we're discussing it, what does endemic really mean? Learn more about long COVID and how to maximize your access to health services. Joining us to shed light on these issues is Dr. Brad Pollack. Dr. Pollack is an ongoing contributor here at the Fight Back podcast and is the chairman of the Department of Public Health Sciences and associate dean for public health sciences at the University of California, UC Davis School of Medicine. Listen in today as we learn about this new phase of the COVID-19 crisis and what it means for us as medical consumers. Let's get started. Thanks for tuning in to the Fight Back podcast. This is Jamie Rosales, health advocate and executive director of the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Remember, you can find all our podcasts on our website at healthcareconsumerrights.org. If you are enjoying the podcast, please consider a gift to help us keep Fight Back available. Your gift can be made at healthcareconsumerrights.org. Enjoy the podcast. Thank you for joining us on the Fight Back podcast. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Brad Pollack from UC Davis. Thank you, Brad, for being here.
Thanks, Jamie. Happy to be back.
You know what? We've had some really incredible conversations with you. And for our listeners that are new, I want to invite them to go to our website, healthcareconsumerrights.org, and listen to some of our other conversations that we've had with you, because you have been an incredible resource for our listeners. And so it is thrilling to me to have you back for us to talk about some of the latest news around COVID. And so, Brad, we've heard kind of the latest big news that's been out there is that the federal government has declared that the pandemic is, quote unquote, over. And while, let's be honest, this is an oversimplification, the emergency order governing a lot of programs and resources is effectively over. Can you tell us what this really means?
Yeah, well, I don't think they said the pandemic was over. I think they said that the emergency orders are being rescinded. And there's a good reason for that, that the emergency orders were put into place originally so we could mobilize all the resources we needed to address the pandemic. And now we're way beyond that. And so I think it did make sense to lift the emergency orders because we're not in that same emergency state. I think there's a difference between that declaration and saying, yeah, well, the pandemic's over. And it's clear that we may be entering into an endemic period. And there's no such thing as a black and white demarcation of when we have the pandemic versus not. I mean, we all kind of knew that. But certainly a lot has changed from the time that the pandemic started, not least of which is that we have preventive measures now with vaccination. We have a much better treatment for people that are infected and develop severe complications. So a lot has changed, and the need to mobilize national resources has changed also. So that's kind of why the emergency orders were lifted both federally and also in many of the states.
Can you explain the difference between an endemic and a pandemic?
Yeah, well, an endemic or endemic disease really refers to having a level of disease in the population that is relatively constant, kind of ongoing. And so as an example of that, we have influenza, right? We've had influenza for a long time. That was the previous pandemic back in 1918. And so we accept that there is going to be a certain amount of influenza on a routine basis. And of course, that's very seasonal, right? The numbers go up and down throughout the year. But we know that every year we will have influenza and it's always with us. And so we've accepted that. So that's called a kind of an endemic level of infection for influenza. With SARS-CoV-2, this virus, we had a pandemic because it was a new virus. It was called a novel virus, and it infected so many people and it caused so much damage. So we were in the middle of an epidemic. Actually, let's kind of define words. So the word epidemic means an occurrence of disease above what you usually expect. And adding the pan in front of it, pandemic, means it's worldwide. And in fact, if you remember at the beginning of this thing, there were, you know, hot spots, you know, Wuhan, China, and then Italy, parts of the States. And it took a couple months for the World Health Organization to declare this to be a pandemic, right? It wasn't immediately declared, even though it occurred in a couple countries. So we use that term pandemic to mean like a very big global type of epidemic. But the endemic just refers to, well, normal steady state, if you will, of a level of disease in the population.
So in other words, the idea that we are in an endemic stage with COVID-19 is essentially the acceptance that there will be some version of COVID-19 around in perpetuity?
Well, I think so, at least for now. I wouldn't guarantee that's the case, because it may be that we develop a vaccine technology that will do a much better job of quashing any sort of recurrence and arresting all these variants that have occurred. So one of the key things about this virus is we've had these variants of concern and then subvariants that have kind of kept the infection going, right? The virus has sort of outsmarted us in terms of vaccines and so on, in terms of infecting people. So you have that going on. And I would say that the vaccine approach that we've used so far has been pretty pretty simple, in that there was an original vaccine which really operated by creating a reaction to the spike protein, right? And then later on, we found we had these variants of concern. That was a spike protein to the original virus. And then we had these variants of concern that happened, and Omicron was the big last huge one that happened. And so they just developed the bivalent vaccine last fall, if you remember, that had protection against the Omicron variant. And so that's, and I actually got my bivalent vaccination back in September. So that may do a little bit better job. But as we're moving forward, the vaccine technology continues to improve. And there's other strategies where, instead of just targeting the spike protein by itself, there are other proteins of the virus that can be targeted at the same time. So you might have a vaccine coming out that will actually attack two sections of the virus that may actually do a better job of having a more stable, maybe a more permanent impact. And so that's what I'm saying. I never say never, but right now it's pretty clear that we're not going to get rid of SARS-CoV-2 infections. They're going to be here to stay, but the nature of what goes on may change depending on vaccine technology. Also, you know, there's still this constant need of the virus to evolve. And so there can be new variants of concern or subvariants that will continue to evolve. And some of those may not really impact things much, but others, you know, randomly could be more severe or actually make the virus even more infectious than it is right now. So people are trying to put their crystal balls on to look at the future, but we really don't know what exactly is going to happen. But I will say this, is that even with our vaccine technology as it is today, that it's highly effective at preventing severe cases of SARS-CoV-2, right? I mean, we know that. And so the strategy of trying to increase vaccination is still a good one. And I think that will continue. And I think this may look much like influenza, in that there's an annual booster shot, right, for influenza vaccines, where they try, the World Health Organization and governments try to get together to predict what the next variants are of influenza, right, and then formulate the vaccine based on the prediction of what they think is going to happen with the mutation of that virus. So we may have something similar to that with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID. So we don't know yet, but I think that at least, you know, the fact that the people who do get vaccinated get an incredible benefit in terms of preventing severe infections and reducing mortality, that's pretty obvious. And that strategy is going to go forward. And I don't know that the virus is going to be able to do a lot in terms of its own evolution to really undo that.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be very interesting to watch moving forward. And I appreciate your comparison to the influenza vaccine, because that's what a lot of folks are used to. They're used to in the fall going and I need to get my flu shot for the year. And so it sounds like that's something that a lot of folks are likely very familiar with.
Yeah. And I just want to add a little bit of anecdotal information on that. So like many people, I kind of assumed many years ago that getting an annual influenza vaccination was like no big deal. I was young, you know, and pretty healthy. And I figured, well, if I end up getting a natural influenza infection, no problem. I'll develop antibodies and they're going to be better. Well, it turned out that about 9 years ago or so, one of our very close friends, a daughter-in-law, who was 34 at the time, ended up getting influenza and she died. I mean, she had an incredible aggressive case that went downhill very quickly. And she was in otherwise perfect health, left behind three young daughters. So it sort of hit me right between the eyeballs when that happened, that this is pretty serious. And there's, you know, on average, you're getting tens of thousands of influenza deaths that happen every year in this country. So it's very serious. Yet a lot of people kind of brush it off. Ah, it's just flu and I don't need to worry about it. So I think, you know, the behavior about influenza vaccination will portend a little bit about what's going on with SARS-CoV-2, is that people will say, yeah, you know, if I get a real natural infection, no big deal. Most people kind of come out of it with very little long-term consequence. However, as we're finding out now, that's not true. It looks like that overall, about 10 to 30% of non-hospitalized cases will develop symptoms that are associated with this long COVID that we're dealing with now. So there are consequences of getting an infection, and trying to avoid infection or serious infection is still a preferred way to do that. And just by way of comparison, that overall only, so I said it's 10 to 30% of non-hospitalized cases will develop long COVID of some sort, and it may not be the most severe form, but overall it's 10 to 12% of vaccinated cases. So vaccination itself does seem to confer some protection.
Isn't that kind of the difference, though? I mean, like if you catch the flu, you know, you go through it, you get through it, versus and this is this the discussion we're having right now about long COVID, which you just introduced. There's a difference between catching the flu, getting over it, and this percentage of people that have caught COVID. Or got COVID and are seeing long-term symptoms.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you put your finger on it. With influenza, if you survive it, you don't develop pneumonia and die, you tend to, you get over it, and there really don't appear to be a lot of long-term consequences of that. Okay. In contrast, infection with SARS-CoV-2, this virus, there seem to now be over 200 symptoms have been identified that cross over multiple organ systems. Oh. So we know there are impacts on the heart, lungs, immune system, the GI tract, neurologic symptoms. There's just a wide range of long-term effects. Now, they're not necessarily all that common, but there's a much more complex mix of different types of long-term impacts from this infection compared to influenza.
So, Brad, let's talk a little bit more in detail about this idea of long COVID. We're starting to hear about it more and more, I think, in our just basic conversations that you have with folks. You're hearing this idea of, oh, I know someone that got COVID and they still are experiencing symptoms. I know you just referenced that there are roughly 200 long-term symptoms that have started to be identified as connected with someone who has contracted COVID-19 at some point or one of these variants. Tell us more about a couple more of those symptoms, or maybe even what should someone be looking for if they've maybe recently had the virus and are concerned that they might be showing signs of long COVID. What should they be looking for? What should they be paying attention to?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. Of course, you know, the first thing that people think about is pulmonary complications, right? Because this virus causes the acute, you know, severe respiratory, right? So that's by definition acute, severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus too. So that says it all, respiratory. So you think about your lungs, and yeah, and a lot of the complications people have is that they're not clearing it. They get an infection and their lungs are, they're functioning, but they're not functioning the same way. They may develop, you know, symptoms that look like a long-term chronic type of a lung affliction. And so that's where people have concentrated. In fact, a lot of the long COVID clinics that have been set up by pulmonologists, that is physicians that study the lung, right? So, but it turns out we're seeing just a lot of effects in other organ systems. I mean, for example, things that look like chronic fatigue syndrome, neurologic symptoms, brain fog, sleep disturbances, memory issues, dizziness, nerve pain. These are things that are, you know, much more neurologically oriented, not pulmonary, right? So I think we're just beginning to scratch the surface now of looking at the complex nature of the kinds of organ systems that are involved in these things. Now, again, you know, there's a baseline level of dysfunction in those organ systems anyway, forgetting about this infection, right? So the question is, how much of a increase is there over what you'd expect normally? And the problem we have is that we don't really have good data systems to collect this in a uniform, reliable manner. That's one of the major issues, one of the major gaps right now, is that how are these getting reported? Now, if you want to just go back a little bit and say, how are we reporting cases of COVID-19, right? That's gone, you know, to heck in a handbasket, as they say, because when we switched from doing PCR testing, which is the only mode that we had available to us, where these were central laboratory confirmed PCR tests, we had a better handle, although not the best handle, but we had a better handle on what was going on with the infection rates in the population. If you recall back, you know, now well over a year ago, when President Biden sent out rapid antigen test kits to people, right? We had the federal government providing these test kits. We went to these rapid tests, and they're not centrally reported. So there, we immediately had a reporting problem of just understanding what the baseline levels of infection were in the population, right? So that was now putting us in some jeopardy in terms of getting accurate counts of who is actually getting infected or not.
So basically what you're saying is the data kind of ran over itself at this point, where, you know, like, for example, and my mom gave me permission to talk about this. She's 79 years old. She got Omicron in December. She's still coughing to this day, to this very day, 6 months, 7 months later. You know, the long COVID story is still being told, and health providers and doctors are still trying to figure out whether it's just naturally occurring problems or if it stems from a COVID infection.
Right. Yeah. So Robert, see, the issue here is that unless you've actually assessed people uniformly and recorded this into some central database, you don't know whether it's just an anecdote or not. I mean, we hear about it more common, but in order to put a precise measure of what's going on, you need to collect the information, right? And you need to have the registries or repositories that are going to allow you to do these statistical comparisons or just to figure out how many people are getting coughs and how severe the coughs are. So the problem we have right now is much like we had with just figuring out who's infected. Now we're trying to figure out who actually gets these long COVID symptoms and how severe are they and do they recur? Are they episodic? Are they chronic? There's a lot of other information that right now we're just reporting out anecdotally, right? We don't actually have the numbers there in a uniform database. So I think I was trying to make the point that long COVID is going to require setting up what we call prospective cohorts, if you will, or prospective registries to track what's going on with populations. So we have the numbers there. I mean, even to look at things like, well, what are the risk factors for long COVID? Mm-hmm. Well, we have some ideas about that. We're seeing higher rates, but that's kind of, again, based on incomplete data. We know that females seem to have a higher rate of having long COVID, people with type 2 diabetes, there's other things like that. But again, we don't have a precise level of estimation of how those risk factors how much do they increase your risk? We don't know that right now because we don't have these databases available to us to track that. And I'll just point out, that's kind of in contrast to something like cancer, where every state and the District of Columbia in the U.S. collect cancer statistics, right? Every new case of cancer is reported to the cancer registries. And we look at the registry data and we characterize who's getting cancer, what are the nature of the demographic and sociodemographic factors that predict that in terms of higher risk, what kind of cancer was it, and so on. We have ways of enumerating that in a very accurate way. We don't have the equivalent now for COVID and particularly for long COVID symptoms. So we need to start collecting that in a more uniform manner than we have been in order to get a more precise idea of what's going on.
What in your opinion, and I'm sorry, Jamie, I'm just going to, but I have a question here. When it comes to long COVID, what has any research shown that long COVID or COVID, any variant, actually stays in the body, like herpes simplex, for example, right? Like it's always somewhere in your body, and it just kind of goes. If you get COVID and you know, you're vaccinated or whatever, why would long COVID symptoms be occurring?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. So there is some thought that, you know, there might be some sanctuary sites where the virus, you know, can lie dormant. I mean, I will say there's things like the herpes viruses, which include herpes zoster and a whole bunch of other herpes viruses that we know integrate in and lie dormant and then can get reactivated. That's what causes shingles, right? So we know that. Not so clear about this virus. And it's unusual for acute respiratory viruses to do that sort of thing. But we don't really know yet, because if you think about how you're going to measure the virus in organs, how do you do that in a live person, right? It's really hard to, you're not going to go in there and biopsy tissue in the lung necessarily. So we don't know what's going on. And then we also don't know about the mechanism. I mean, a lot of these long-term symptoms here, you know, the immune system is very complex. And so you start messing around with it with an infection. But even things like your microbiome, right, which is the normal constitution of your gut flora, for example, you know, this virus can mess around with that. And we now know more and more that the microbiome does have an impact on a lot of other kinds of diseases and symptoms that people have. So it's very complex. But I would say we're just at the baby steps right now of trying to put this together. I mean, why do some people get neurologic symptoms? What's going on with that? Is it actually a live virus in your body that's causing that? Or is it the fact that you've challenged your immune system and that's caused a whole cascade of other impacts? Maybe what you're measuring there is the impact of your immune system, not the virus directly, but it was set off by it, but now your immune system's taken over and is playing tricks on you. So we don't know that. There's a lot of research that is just starting to get launched right now to look much more at the mechanism by which these long-term symptoms are occurring. But we don't have that together right now. There's a lot of theories about this. And again, whether it's the fact that the virus stays, you know, sort of somewhere in your body and it gets reactivated in specific organs or not, we don't really know right now. People are starting to look at that. So we should, over time, have a better handle on the potential mechanism by which these things occur. But we don't have that right now.
Thanks for joining us for this very interesting discussion on the Fight Back podcast. Please help keep this free podcast available with a $5 gift today on our website at healthcareconsumerrights.org. So I have to admit, I am just fascinated with some of these research comments that you're talking about, Brad, and some of the ways that they're looking at the virus and its impact. And is it really the impact of the virus, or is it the fact that the virus has compromised someone's immune system? And so now there's this domino effect of symptoms or impacts of an immune system in crisis, essentially.
Right.
Can you? Right. I mean, I'm very curious to hear if there's, can you tell us if there's more? We've talked a lot about research that's happening right now, that there's a problem with data collection, and hope it sounds like people are starting to look at ways to collect this so that we can learn more about long COVID. But I think a companion question to not only what research is happening for us to understand what this diagnosis
is and what it means and what it does. But what about how we take care of patients who have been identified and diagnosed as patients who have long COVID? Is there research being done to treat them? Are there treatments that are available for patients? I'm very curious in this in-between time that we're here right now with long COVID, where we're still doing research, we're still learning about it. What options are out there for patients that are suffering with some of these symptoms?
Yeah, well, so Jamie, you kind of went through a couple of major steps you're talking about. Let me back up a little bit here, which is there are other kind of conditions where this issue about, well, is it the virus or is it your immune system that causes the problem? Well, I can tell you from a personal standpoint, I ended up having a zoster infection. I had shingles. I had chickenpox as a kid, and then I ended up with shingles probably about 16 or 17 years ago. And it's kind of random where the shingles can occur. A lot of for most people, it's around the trunk of the body. I ended up having it in the eye. I had, which is terrible. I had it to the point where the cornea turned opaque for a couple of days because of what was going on with the acute infection. And then the infection resolved. I was being treated by an ophthalmologist where they use steroid drops, and they also were taking antiviral drops. And anyway, the long and short of it is many people that get shingles in the eye will have permanent damage to the cornea where they actually can, you know, have their visual acuity impacted. Well, I was lucky I didn't, but I had this ongoing situation where my cornea occasionally would flare. This is years after I had the shingles, and it would flare up. And if you looked at my cornea closely, it looked like I had an infection in the cornea where it would again get clouded, and it would sort of dissolve, if you will, by going back on steroid drops in the eye. So this is interesting because I talked to a number of ophthalmologists at the time and even beyond that about what's going on. Is it the herpes zoster virus that's getting reactivated in the cornea?
Right.
Is it something else? And some people were under the impression that, no, it's not the virus itself, but it's that you're developing an immune reaction, and the immune reaction is causing that flare and those symptoms. So there's even a situation here where it's not resolved what exactly goes on with people that have herpes ophthalmic. I think the eye impact of herpes zoster. It's not clear about that. So I want to go back with long COVID, same thing, that we don't know a chicken and the egg thing, what's going on with that. And so that makes it a little bit difficult. And to move into your then questions about, well, what do you do? How do you diagnose this? And then what are the treatments that you have available to you? Well, first of all, I have to say that although many, many people have been affected, millions now, we don't have enough information about the more longer term impacts of this. Many of these symptoms resolve over time, and we can't even get accurate estimates of the resolution rate, if you will, of a lot of these symptoms because we don't have the databases for that. But we think that many of these things will sort of fade away over time. Coughs may sort of get diminished and almost, you know, disappear over time for many people. For others, they won't do that. So I think one thing is we still don't have clarity about how common it is to have these things resolve on their own. And then the issue is if they resolve on their own, is that because your immune system is now operating differently? We don't know that. So in terms of treatment, you know, a lot of times these symptoms will be treated with the kinds of standard treatments we have to treat other symptoms that occur like this, but there's no master treatment here. You know, now it's interesting because they've even done some studies for people that that have long COVID symptoms to actually give them COVID vaccines either again or for the first time. And in fact, when that happens, this is tried as a treatment. Some people resolved. Other people, the symptoms got worsened. So, and the numbers for that are, these are very small studies, but it's kind of like almost comparable rates of that happening. So is getting a vaccine the answer once you've developed long COVID or not? We don't know that, but it seems very controversial. Using antivirals, that is drugs that actually attack the virus, you know, there's no long-term, you know, larger studies that have been done to look at that. But these are some of the tricks that people would be, you know, looking at. And I think, I haven't combed the literature right now to see if there's some trials going on with antivirals. That might be one approach. But I think right now it's just trying to characterize, you know, what is happening with risk factors. So another example, when we talk about like, well, who's at higher risk? It seems that people that had reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus infections And EBV, or Epstein-Barr virus, is very common. You know, all kids get it. Sometimes symptomatically you develop mononucleosis, right? That's one of the outcomes from EBV. But I'd say the majority of us, by the time we're adults, have been exposed to the Epstein-Barr virus at some point. And most of us, it doesn't cause any impacts at all that we can measure. But it looks like there are people that have reactivation of EBV, where they have very low numbers, and then the virus gets reactivated. That seems to be associated with these long COVID symptoms, right? The presence of specific antibodies seems to be as well. And there's other things like connective tissue disorders, which also seem to be a risk factor for developing long COVID symptoms. So I mentioned females are at higher risk, and type 2 diabetes patients are as well. Well, these things all, I mean, not the female part, but the type 2 diabetes, that's kind of an odd thing that's related to obesity. Type 1 would be something related to more autoimmune disease. But, you know, we're just scratching the surface right now at trying to identify the risk factors. And as an epidemiologist, that's what I do for a living. We try to understand what the etiology or the causes of disease are. And we do that by studying populations. But in order to do that, you have to collect the data that allow you to start doing analyses to look at these specific statistical associations to put together kind of a framework for what may be the major causes. And then, of course, all of these potential risk factors could potentially interact with each other, right? So it could be having two or three of these risk factors really put you over the edge for developing severe long-term symptoms. So we don't know yet right now, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, Jamie. If I had to put you at the free throw line right now, Dr. Pollack.
Yes.
what is, I'm just super fascinated by this. If you had to guess, and I'm not putting you on the line, sure. You got to hit the free throw. Is this something that long COVID is being caused by, if you catch COVID, is it remaining in the body?
That I don't know. I would say, if I were a betting man, probably not. It's again, like almost all acute respiratory infections, I think people develop an immune response that is robust at some point. Not everybody, but the vast majority of us will. And the virus doesn't, there's no evidence that gets integrated into your DNA, unlike, you know, like some other viruses.
Herpes is right. Forever.
Yes, it gets integrated in, and it lies dormant in the ganglia of your nervous system. And it just lies there. There's a sanctuary site for it. We don't have any strong evidence of that right now with this virus, although people are looking at it with much more detail. Maybe there is some part of the body, some part of your organ system where that happens, but we don't have evidence for that yet. So yeah. Again, if I looked at the analogy of other infectious diseases of this type, respiratory diseases, you know, there's not a precedent for these things having this long-term sequestering away and then coming out later on and doing some right. Damage. Singles, right? We don't see that, but you know, never say never. And you know, again, without in the absence of data, it is a free throw here.
Yeah, no, I know. That's why I asked. Thank you.
Sure.
So then, maybe a question, kind of coming on the heels of that, is it sounds like there is, but just for the folks at home that might still be wondering. Are there people out there who are working to collect this data so that we can answer some of these questions that we've talked about today?
The answer is yes. I think, again, there's some of us scientists have our hands out looking for some federal support to develop these databases. But there has been, like, the National Institutes of Health, NIH, has had a number of requests for proposals or funding announcements for people to be starting to collect this sort of long-term data in larger numbers. So there are efforts underway to do this. You know, how large are those efforts? Is there enough money being put into it? I don't really know right now, but it does look like the federal government is looking for ideas and is funding research to do this. So that's a good thing. Okay. I would say, if you really pull back here, I mean, if we really think about, this is not the solution, because we'd love to have a magic mechanism worked out for what's going on and then have these specific interventions to prevent it. But there's one thing that seems very clear. One is not getting COVID obviously is a very good prevention from long COVID, right? So that's right. That sounds silly, but that is true. The other thing is, while it's not proven definitively right now, it's likely that being vaccinated reduces the risk of long COVID symptoms. So that's the other key take-home point. Again, we don't have, you know, super definitive evidence with clinical trial data yet, but it does look like folks that are vaccinated do have much lower rates of developing long COVID. So that's right. Another strategy that seems to be working right now. But again, because this hit the population with so many people infected, you know, not only in the United States, but worldwide, we're going to be seeing a lot more long COVID. And so as we do this and we're capturing that information, it will allow us to get a better handle on what's going on. And that's going to be necessary in order to start coming up with some ideas about interventions we might be able to deploy that will reduce the incidence of long COVID.
So I think, Brad, I'd like to shift gears. The information that you have provided has been excellent, just like always. But I'd like to shift gears a little. And one of the things that I always think about when we talk about these types of things is, well, what if you have long COVID, or you think you do? What do you do then? If you have a loved one that you think might be potentially could be diagnosed with this, what do we do? What should a patient do who thinks that they might be sick in this way?
Yeah, well, I think there for some of the symptoms, there may be nothing to do about it because we don't have a remedy or intervention. But I do think that you're seeing more and more clinics pop up now. A lot of health care organizations have organized long COVID clinics. We have one at UC Davis. And so you're now starting to see medical expertise brought in to try to deal with some of the range of these symptoms that folks are experiencing in a uniform way. As I mentioned, I think the folks that started that were mostly pulmonologists to begin with, but now you're starting to see multidisciplinary clinics develop for long COVID, which bring in neurology and other medical specialties to be able to look at what's going on. And so that depends on where you live, what your access to healthcare is, and what healthcare organizations are doing. But because it's become such a prevalent issue, you are seeing more and more of those clinics open up. And I think, again, we're at the infant steps right now of knowing what to do, but getting some medical attention is going to be important, but also contributing to, you know, the foundation of developing the data that we need to be able to make inferences is also really important. So those clinics are all, you know, sort of on data systems now where they're trying to amass information about what's going on. But, you know, again, there may be some things like a chronic cough. You go see somebody, they do a lung x-ray, for example, and they don't see anything right there, but you're still coughing away. They might try some therapy. And again, I'm not a physician, so I don't treat patients myself, but you might be going on inhalers and things like this that would maybe ease those symptoms, make you feel better about that. But again, that's kind of treating the symptom rather than going down to the exact cause. And the cause here is still going to come down to understanding much more about the mechanism by which infection with this virus has impacted the body and, you know, how it sets up the cascade of events that occur. You know, we have some diseases where actually doing immune suppression resolves the symptoms, right? There's many autoimmune diseases like that where some of the therapy for things like inflammatory bowel disease are modulated by steroid therapy, for example. Now, it's not great to go on long-term steroids, but there are ways of getting the body to sort of respond without knowing the underlying mechanism. We don't know what causes inflammatory bowel disease like colitis and Crohn's disease. We don't know the causes. We know there's associations, but we do know that people that get certain therapies in the past, it was things like prednisone, will suppress those symptoms. Now we have other drugs, biologics now, that interfere directly with some of the immune operation and cellular function that actually modulate those symptoms. So we have a better idea, but we still haven't identified what the risk, what the cause is of those diseases. And we're treating the symptoms, and that's a good thing because people feel good. They don't suffer from those symptoms. So we may end up in the same boat with some of the symptoms that are related to SARS-CoV-2 infection.
Well, it sounds like we've got a little bit of waiting to do based on what you're saying. But we also, for those who are suffering with long COVID, it also sounds like they can be hopeful that there are some potential remedies coming online for them in the future that can provide some support for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I'd recommend people try to go to some of the clinics that have been established now that really have the multidisciplinary approach, where they have medical specialists from different areas of medicine that are working together to try to best take care of these patients. That's really advised. And you're seeing more and more of these spring up, of course, because there's a market demand, right? We have a lot of people mm-hmm. that develop these long-term symptoms. So my recommendation is to try to go to medical providers that have those kinds of operations to get, you know, again, help with what's going on and careful monitoring and so on. But certainly there are ways of alleviating some of those symptoms without, again, necessarily going to the root cause. So you'll have that available to you if you're going to one of these clinics.
Well, this has been an incredibly fascinating conversation. Dr. Brad Pollack, thank you for joining us here on the Fight Back podcast. I have to be honest, I'm really already looking forward to our next conversation because I can't wait to hear from you hopefully several months what might be going on here so that we can learn some more. I know this is a huge issue for a lot of folks that are listening or maybe a loved one that they have. And so thank you for all the information you provided today. And I look forward to the next time we can talk some more about this.
Well, I'd be happy to come back, Jamie and Robert. And thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll talk soon.
I want to thank you for listening to today's Fight Back podcast. Our mission is to be a resource and provide you with healthcare information in a refreshing and interesting format. Thank you to Dr. Brad Pollack, our ongoing contributor here at the Fight Back podcast. For more information, go to our website, healthcareconsumerrights.org. While on our website, you can check out additional podcasts or access more information and resources to help you navigate the healthcare system and get the care you deserve. We also welcome your input and stories that we can use on future podcasts. This is Jamie Rosales, and this is Fight Back, a podcast by the Healthcare Consumer Rights Foundation. Thanks for listening. I look forward to our next podcast. Talk with you soon. We hope you enjoyed the Fight Back podcast today. This is a free podcast available to provide consumers with quality information to help you fight for the healthcare you deserve. We are brought to you by listener supporters. Please consider making a $5 gift on our website, healthcareconsumerrights.org, to help keep Fight Back available for all listeners.